You're listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of Rudolf Steiner's lecture cycle, The Life Between Death and Rebirth. This is lecture 7. In the course of this winter, we have given various preparatory lectures to help you to understand the whole life of man more exactly than could be done in previous years. How it runs its course, on the one hand, in the physical world, between birth and death, and on the other hand, in the spiritual world, between death and rebirth. It is now necessary to consider many details, which will contribute to the fuller understanding of this matter, to gather together and throw light upon many things which we have already considered from other aspects. Today I shall ask you, in the first place, to recall our studies on the course of human physical life, which I deal with in my booklet titled The Education of the Child from the Standpoint of Spiritual Science. How in it the course of life was presented as running in cycles, one cycle from birth to about the seventh year, or let us say to the change of teeth, a second cycle from this period to puberty, about the 14th year, then a third cycle, the cycles thus running in periods of 7 years. Though it is clear that even according to external observation, the division of life into cycles is fully justified, it may appear in actual human life that these cycles cannot be maintained exactly, and that they are crossed by other facts which have a large share in human life. We have frequently drawn attention to one important fact which plays an important part in human life, and which does not agree with this division into cycles. This is the point of time to which a person's memory reaches back during life, and from which he really begins to know and feel himself as a I, capital, the period when the consciousness of I dawns. This event does not always take place exactly at the same time, but in most cases it happens between birth and the seventh year. We shall have something similar to say in regard to later life. There are other things which to a certain extent disarrange the periodic cycle of 7 years in the life of man, although they do not break in upon human life so abruptly as this flashing forth of the eye consciousness. And we always find that anything entering human life and going against the periodic cycles is much more irregular than the true cyclic experiences. You will scarcely find two human beings whose memory reaches back to exactly the same time, or who experience dawn of the I consciousness at exactly the same time. Neither do two human beings cast their first teeth at exactly the same time, but we shall speak later of the reason for this. When we study the cyclic periods mentioned above, we notice that these periods have a certain peculiarity. They begin with what is most physical in man and proceed inward. We observe that from birth to the seventh year, the development is devoted principally to the physical body, then to the etheric body, then to the astral body, the sentient soul, etc. Thus the factors in this evolution proceed more and more from what is external to what is internal. This is a peculiarity of the seven-year periods. Now, how does the matter stand with respect to that which enters and crosses these cycles in the manner we have just described? The flashing forth of the consciousness of I in the first cycle is a very interior thing, markedly interior. In order to make this quite clear, let us consider something which contrasts with this flashing out of the I consciousness. In any thoughtful observation of human life, we find that we may compare the cessation of growth, which comes about in human life, with other things which also work against the seven-year periods of development. Let us consider the fact of the cessation of growth, which in the case of man occurs very late. How does this occur in human life? When we consider the first cycle of 7 years, we find that it ends with the second dentition. The production of the second teeth is the last act of what may be called the quote, expression of the form principle, close quote. The formative forces in man give their final touch, as it were, when they produce the teeth. That is the culmination of the formative forces in man, after which the principle which molds the human form does not really come into action any further. What appears later is only an enlargement of what has already been laid down. After the seventh year, man's brain is not subjected to any special remodeling. What has already been laid down simply grows. By that time, the essential form has already been given to man. The rest is only growth. Therefore, we may say that the formative principle develops its activity during the first 7 years of human life. We might now inquire, when these spirits of form have worked upon man up to the age of seven, does that conclude everything they do for him? No, man then grows. He grows and develops further the germs of form he has received. If nothing more were to happen, he would go on growing continually. Were we to consider only the principles of form active in man up to the age of seven, there is no reason why these should not go on enlarging. There is no reason why man or any other being should not go on growing. But something else does happen. When man begins to grow, other principles of form approach him. They creep upon him the whole time, and fully unite with his organism in such a way that they act as a hindrance, and the organism cannot grow any more. The principles of form that are active up to the seventh year give man elasticity. Then other principles of form enter, and these are of such a nature that they imprison in limited forms what is otherwise elastic, and growth gradually ceases. And at the point when growth ceases, those principles of form are active, which approach man from outside. When formative principles are active, and form grows, the cessation of growth is always provided for by other principles of form, which encounter the first from the opposite direction. This is the case in man. When man has built up his form to the age of seven, there's a drawing, it might go on growing indefinitely. The principles of form have worked within the lined portion until the seventh year. Other principles of form then come to meet them. The first work from within, the second from without, obstructing the growth of man, so that he can only grow within the faintly lined portion as far as to the line, and there's some B to B in the sketch. It is as if man has an elastic garment, which he can continually enlarge until the seventh year. Then at a certain time a garment is given him, which is not elastic. This he must put on, and he cannot then grow beyond it. In man, form principles from within meet with form principles from without. The first come from those spirits of form which have passed through a regular development in the cosmos. The second category of form principles, those working from without, are not of the same kind. They come from backward spirits of form, from spirits of form who have acquired a luciferic character. These work in a purely spiritual manner, but those who work through what is material work in a regular manner. They have gone through evolution correctly, through Saturn, Sun, and Moon, and have come in an orderly way to the earth, and fashioned the form of man from within. The abnormal spirits of form work in such a way that they receive what is presented to them and hold it back in the manner described. Thus man's growth is checked by these backward spirits of form. The beings of the higher hierarchies have many different tasks, and one of them has just been described. In previous lectures, we have told of the various ways in which the regular hierarchies work, and also how backward spiritual beings work from the different hierarchies. We have also described, as you may read in Esoteric Science or Occult Science, how man really reached the position where he could obtain the germ of the ego through the spirits of form. We know that man received the germ of the physical body through the thrones or spirits of will, the germ of the etheric body through the spirits of wisdom, that of the astral body through the spirits of movement. and through the spirits of form he received into his physical body the germ of the I, or ego. Man is first organized into an I-being by the normal spirits of form, into that which expresses him outwardly during the first cycle of life. Later, through the opponents of these spirits of form, through the backward spirits of form, his growth is checked. We have now arrived at something which is the opposite of that which appears in man at first, and which is, at the same time, the most inward thing in him, namely, the flashing forth of the I-consciousness. That which is innermost appears in the first years. That which is outermost, the upbuilding of the form, is checked only in later years. This is a concluding act. We recognize, therefore, two evolutions opposing each other in man. I have said regarding one line of evolution that it comes from outside and proceeds inward, affecting the sentient soul at the age of 21. Then we have another development. This proceeds from within, outward, from the spiritual to the corporeal, and affects the growth of the form. The first development, the regular one, which is particularly interesting from the educational standpoint, proceeds from within, without, inward. The second, which is much more irregular and more individual, proceeds from within outward and expresses itself when man has reached a certain age, in the completion of what is most external, namely the physical body. Thus two opposing lines of evolution are working in man, and knowledge of this is very important for those who have charge of children. Hence in my book, The Education of Children, the first line of development is justly taken into account, the one which proceeds from without inward, because only there can we educate. On the other line of development, which proceeds from within outward, we cannot work at all. That is a matter of individual development. It is something which may indeed be taken into account, but which cannot be arrested, and for it little can be done. It is most important to distinguish between what may be educated and what may not. Just as the cessation of growth depends upon the backward spirits of form, the first appearance of the I, or ego, in the early years of childhood comes from backward spirits of will. Between these, a number of events occur in which backward spirits of wisdom and backward spirits of motion are active. It is impossible to describe the entire life of man, including his life between death and rebirth, unless we gather together all the factors which influence him, and unless we know that even in ordinary life, the influence of beings with a luciferic tendency manifests in many different ways. As in these group lectures, our wish and endeavor is to understand the whole life of man. We must not shrink from entering somewhat deeply into the consideration of these tendencies. We shall first direct your attention to something which may show that life on the physical plane between birth and death has changed essentially in the course of human evolution. And when we understand this, we shall be able to perceive how the life between death and rebirth has also changed. Anyone who considers life in a superficially intellectual manner may easily think that on the whole it has always been like it is now, but we need only go back a few centuries to find that certain things were quite different. There is, for example, at the present time, something extremely important to the soul life of man between birth and death, which did not exist in its present form a few centuries ago, namely that which is now covered by the term, quotes, public opinion. In the 13th century, it would have been foolish to speak of public opinion in the modern sense. A great deal is now being said against belief in authority, but belief in authority exists in a much stronger form than in the earlier centuries, which are so often abused. Certainly many foolish things were thought at that time, but there was not such a blind belief in authority as there is now. The blindness of this belief is usually expressed in the fact that one cannot lay one's finger on the authority. Today, when, for one reason or another, a person states something, he is very soon floored by the remark, quote, "Science has proved this or that," close quote. In former centuries, people put much more faith. Excuse me, let me read that again. In former centuries, people put more faith in authorities which confronted them bodily. But reference to the intangible, when they say, quote, science has proved it, close quote, is a very questionable thing. Something is contained in this which bases its belief in an intangible authority which in former centuries did not exist. At the present time in our civilization, most people trouble themselves very little about things concerning which the most simple and primitive human being in former centuries tried to know something in his own way, namely things concerning health and disease. For why need anyone now know anything about health and disease? The doctors know all about it, and we can leave the management to them. That is also something which at the present time comes under the heading of, quote, an undiscoverable supreme authority, close quote. There is something else which intrudes everywhere into human life, to which we are subject from earliest youth, and through which opinions and tendencies of feeling press into our life. This intangible something, which whirls in living currents among human beings, is usually called public opinion, and regarding it, philosophers have said, quote, public opinions are mostly private mistakes, close quote. The principal thing, however, is not that we should know that public opinions are most frequently private mistakes, but that public opinions exercise an extraordinary power over the life of individuals. It would be a foolish idea of history if one were to say that in the 13th century, public opinion influenced the life of the individual. There were individual personalities at that time, and these exercised an authority with respect to one or thing or another. They were obeyed, whether in practical affairs or in matters of government. But that which has now become impersonal public opinion did not then exist. Let anyone who does not wish to believe this from occult facts study the history of Florence during the centuries when the government of the city had passed into the hands of the Medici. He will then see how strong individual authority was, but public opinion did not yet exist. This only developed about 4 or 5 centuries ago, when we can really speak of the rise of public opinion. We must look back upon these things as realities. They represent a very real sphere of thoughts that fly about. Whence comes this, which we often accept as something that cannot be substantiated? What is this public opinion? You will perhaps remember my having spoken of spiritual beings who belong to the hierarchies immediately above man, and who participate in various ways in the guidance of man. You need but read my book, The Spiritual Guidance of Man, where you will find certain spiritual beings mentioned belonging to the higher hierarchies. Now we also know that the greatest impulse within the earthly evolution of humanity was given by the mystery of Golgotha. Through this, something came to pass which is expressed in a most wonderful manner in the esoteric teaching of Paul. Paul spoke in a simple manner, but there is a profound esotericism behind his words. He could not always say openly what he knew as an initiate, for in the first place he wished to speak to a wider public. And secondly, it was not possible in his day to give out all he knew in the only way in which it could be said. There is a deep esotericism behind his method of presenting what he had to say. For example, we find that there is a profoundly important fact behind the distinction he draws between the first generations of Adam and the, quote, higher Adam, close quote, Christ. According to Paul, the various generations of mankind originated from the first Adam, because their bodies originated from him. The spread of humanity over the earth in the various epochs can be traced back ultimately to the physical body of Adam, Adam and Eve, of course. What lies behind the physical evolution of humanity from Adam? Naturally, the evolution of the soul. In the physical bodies which sprang from Adam, souls live. These souls which came down from space brought with them a certain spiritual heritage, a heritage of spiritual possessions, but in course of time this spiritual endowment diminished. Those who lived 6,000 or 7,000 years B.C. had much greater spiritual possessions than those who lived during the first 1,000 years before the mystery of Golgotha. The spiritual possessions man once brought with him have gradually melted away in his soul, and with regard to these, the life between death and rebirth comes specially under consideration. When we look far back into the period before the mystery of Golgotha, we find that mankind after death had an active and clear soul life, but this gradually grew dim and dark, till human beings took with them but a dim soul life when they passed beyond death. Wise men among the Greeks, although they were the most advanced people on the earth, could well say with regard to the progress of evolution, quote, "Better be a beggar in the upper world than a king in the realm of the shades." Close quote. This statement applied well to the Greeks, because they were fully satisfied with life on the physical plane. But as soon as they passed through death, their life became shadowy. The spiritual life which humanity brought with it, and which was manifest after death more as a clairvoyant consciousness, had grown dim, and particularly in the fourth post-Atlantean age, that in which the mystery of Golgotha took place, it had reached its darkest limit. The thing of most importance in the baptism by John was that certain of those whom he baptized became aware of this fact. His baptism was a complete submersion, whereby the etheric body was driven out, and the person baptized became clairvoyant for a short time while under water. John was able to reveal to them the fact that with regard to the life of the soul, man had so deteriorated in the course of ages that he now possessed very little of the spiritual treasure that once was his, which he could carry with him through the portal of death, and which gave him clairvoyant consciousness. Those baptized by John perceived that a renewal of the life of their soul was necessary. Something new had to pour into their souls in order that life after death might again develop. And this new thing entered their souls through the mystery of Golgotha. If you read the course of lectures entitled From Jesus to Christ, you will see how a rich spiritual life streams from the mystery of Golgotha and pours into those who are able to develop a relation to this mystery upon earth, and how, from that moment, souls are reanimated. For this reason, Paul could say that just as physical human bodies originate from Adam, so the contents of human souls will originate more and more from Christ, the second Adam, the spiritual Adam. That is a profound truth, clothed by Paul in simple words. If the mystery of Golgotha had not taken place, man would have lost the contents of his soul more and more, and would either have come to long for a life outside the physical body, or he would have continued to live on earth, filled with desires for a purely physical life. He would have become more and more materialistic. As everything in evolution comes about slowly and gradually, the original spiritual possession with which man was endowed has not yet been lost by all the peoples on the earth. There are still some who possess a little of the ancient spiritual treasure, although they have not come into connection with the mystery of Golgotha. The most advanced peoples, however, can only gain consciousness after death to the extent to which they have been able to, quote, capital letters, die into Christ, close quote, as said in the central portion of the Rosicrucian motto. So that the mystery of Golgotha has actually acted like an irradiation of the contents of human souls on the earth. When we bear all this in mind, we are able to answer a certain question in connection with the evolution of humanity, namely, quote, what has really happened through man having gained the capacity to have soul content poured into his eye through understanding the mystery of Golgotha? What is the difference between this soul content and the other which existed as an ancient heritage before the mystery of Golgotha? Close quote, I believe. Sorry, I think it's missing. The difference is that before the mystery of Golgotha, man possessed this soul content in a much more dependent manner. He was much more under the direct guidance of beings whom we know as angels, archangels, etc., beings who belong to the hierarchy next above us. Before the mystery of Golgotha, these beings led man in a very much more dependent manner than after it. The progress of the beings to the higher hierarchies, the angels, archangels, and archai, consists in their learning more and more how to guide man in a manner suited to his evolving independence. Man is to become more and more independent on earth. The guiding spiritual beings, belonging to the higher hierarchies, have learned this, and in this their progress consists. But their nature is such that it is also possible for them to remain behind. Not all the spirits participating in the guidance of man have gained the capacity, through the mystery of Golgotha, to guide and lead man in a free way. Among these hierarchies are some beings who have not advanced, who have acquired a luciferic character, and what we now call public opinion belongs to what some of these express. Public opinion is formed not merely by human beings, but also by certain luciferic spirits, backward angels and archangels who are at the lowest stage. These are only beginning their luciferic career. They have not yet risen very high in the ranks of the luciferic spirits, but they are luciferic spirits. With seer's vision, it is possible to observe how certain spirits belonging to the higher hierarchies have not kept pace with evolution since the mystery of Golgotha, and how they are growing hard and fixed in the old ways of guidance, and are therefore unable to approach man directly. Those who have kept pace with evolution are able to approach man in the way ordained. Those who have not kept pace cannot approach, but act as a hazy, confused thought power, public opinion. We only understand the function of public opinion when we know how it enters humanity. We have here, directly before us, the phenomenon of beings falling away from a regular development and taking on a luciferic character. It is important to recognize this, for the luciferic beings we have already become acquainted with and who have greater power began also in a small way. The entire host of the luciferic beings began in a small way. There was no public opinion, however, on the ancient moon, but there was something that may be compared to it, a sort of guidance of man. If we consider the leaders among the luciferic spirits, we find that those we mentioned previously, who are mighty and important beings, for example, the spirits of form, they approach man in a way that checks his growth. Speaking of others of the army of luciferic spirits, these are only, as it were, recruits. But something begins here, in the career of these luciferic spirits, which will later assume entirely different dimensions, because the spirits involved become more and more powerful. Public opinion, which we meet on the physical plane, and which is guided and directed by certain luciferic beings of the lowest kind, must, because man accepts it between birth and death, be balanced in the life between death and rebirth. That is to say, as man is caught up into the stream we have just characterized in his life between birth and death, he must experience a corresponding counterpoise between death and rebirth. If he did not, the following would happen. The spirits who have fallen behind and who cause public opinion have no importance and no power at all in the life man passes through between death and rebirth. They have entirely relinquished the power to work there, because they already work here on the physical plane in a spiritual way as public opinion. Man cannot take public opinion with him into the spiritual world. It would be out of place to make use of it after death. Although this may sound strange to many, it must be stated that all public opinion, everything which influences man's judgment at a comparatively early age, makes his life in Kamaloka difficult if he depends upon and likes these things, and particularly it does so for those who think that they maintain their own independent judgment within public opinion, which they never do. After Kamaloka, public opinion has no meaning. After death, it is really not of the smallest value whether people hold such varieties of public opinion as we call liberal or conservative, radical or reactionary. It is of no importance in the formation of the various groups of human beings, and is only established on earth in order to prevent people making the progress they should make in the gain of illumination of consciousness after death. The beings who are at the back of public opinion wish to remain behind the progress introduced through the mystery of Golgotha. This mystery will, however, acquire ever greater and greater significance for the evolution of the earth. We must clearly understand that the future evolution of the earth will not come about through the improvement of such things as public opinion, etc., which are a necessity in evolution, but through inward improvement. Therefore, evolution must affect the inner being of man more and more, so that in the future, when he will have to confront an increasingly stronger public opinion, his inner being will also have grown stronger. This can only be brought about through anthroposophy. It will only be possible for man to become a match for those spirits who appear as the recruits of the luciferic beings and who now find expression as public opinion, if between birth and death he also experiences something which strengthens his inner being, which strengthens that in him which is independent of earthly life. Whereas, through public opinion, man makes himself more and more dependent upon earthly life, he must acquire between death and rebirth something which in his next earthly life will liberate him from this more and more. This is connected with the fact that exactly at the time public opinion appeared and obtained some importance, Buddha's kingdom was founded upon Mars, so that between death and rebirth, man now passes through Buddha's kingdom on Mars. Christian Rosenkreuz gave to Buddha the mission of working in a special manner upon Mars. When man goes through the Mars sphere, between death and rebirth, he has to experience what would not be good here upon the earth, namely the wish to escape from earthly conditions. Among other things, he there strips off the vehicle of public opinion, which only has meaning for the earth. Much more oppressive things will come to pass in the future, and it will be all the more necessary for man to go through what he can experience as the pupil of Buddha on Mars. People can only be followers of Buddha here on earth if they do not wish to go along with the more advancing part of the inhabitants of the earth. Between death and rebirth, however, Buddha unfolds that which has developed out of the teaching he gave while on earth, namely that man ought to get away from the need of incarnation, a teaching which is useless to human life on the earth, for he must go from incarnation to incarnation. Thus what Buddha gave upon earth contained the seed of what man needs in his discarnate state. The progressed teaching of Buddha is right for the period between death and rebirth. And as Buddha reappeared in the astral body of the Jesus of St. Luke's Gospel, Christ himself now leads man between death and rebirth, for he leads him through the Mars sphere, so that he may acquire the advanced teaching of Buddha, so that in the sphere of Mars he may be freed from what he acquires on earth through public opinion, which makes people uniform, not individual, and is useless for their further progress. Although in former times Mars was called the planet of the warlike virtues, it is Buddha's task, gradually, so to change the warlike virtues in man, that they may provide a foundation for a free and independent character in the way that has become necessary at the present time. Whereas man is now inclined to relinquish his feeling of freedom for that which, in the shape of public opinion, would bind him more and more, upon Mars, between death and rebirth, he will strive to break these fetters and not bring them with him when he returns again to a new incarnation. In this connection, we have something which, it seems to me, shows in a most wonderful way how wisdom rules in the world, how everything which is progressing and everything which is falling behind is ultimately so guided that harmony is the final result of this evolution. Man cannot really accomplish progress by keeping to the middle line, as it were. Many reach this truth by perceiving that one cannot take up a one-sided position on any standpoint. Out in the world we find idealists, materialists, and other ists who swear by their standpoint. Great minds, such as Goethe, do not do this. They seek to grasp material conditions through material thought, and what is spiritual through idealistic thought. Then smaller minds, thinking they have grasped this, say, quote, "When there are two different standpoints, the truth lies halfway between them," close quote. Though that is very much the same as if in practical life someone wished to sit between two chairs. The truth is only found when one does not take up one standpoint or another in a one-sided manner, when one is able to use the materialistic method of cognition and the idealistic method in the appropriate manner. We do not progress by always keeping the happy mean. The mean is present in the proper way, even though the various sides are there, and one considers them as forces. If, for example, we wish to weigh something, we require not only what is between the scales, but also the two scale pans. Besides what exists as public opinion, there must be its counterpoise, namely the teaching of Buddha on Mars, which would not have been there if public opinion had not first arisen. Everything alive needs polarity, it needs contrast. We cannot merely do away with the various contrasts, for life advances in accordance with the conditions of polarity. Some people might think that as the South Pole and the North Pole are opposite to each other, it would be better if neither of them were there, even though they are not contrasted in the way thought of by the professor, of whom it is said that he wrote his book so quickly that he could not reflect upon what he was writing, and it happened that he wrote the sentence, "Civilization could only develop in the central zone of the earth, for at the North Pole people would freeze with cold, and at the South Pole melt with heat." In another sense, the North and South Poles are really polar opposites, which must be there, because progress is made not through what is neutral, but through the maintenance and harmonizing of opposites. Hence, that which is developing on the earth had to pass through a condition which is below the level of progress. Public opinion is of less value than that which the individual can gain as opinion when he is advancing. It is subhuman. The Buddha stream which man passes through between death and rebirth is opposed to this subhuman quality. Both have to be there. It is extremely important to consider this in evolution. Thus, it is the fact that there are backward spirits, but everything which on the one hand remains behind and on the other goes beyond the norm of evolution is so ordered by the wisdom of the world that out of it at length comes harmony. Backward spirits are used to form the opposite pole to spirits who have advanced further. If we consider life in this way, it will be clear to us that in the future evolution of the earth, man will bring with him more and more into life tendencies which will make themselves felt in a different way from purely physical tendencies. It will become more and more apparent that we shall have to deal with tendencies in man which are different from the merely physical tendencies. We shall find physical tendencies which, although they may only manifest themselves gradually, may be traced back to infancy. But other tendencies will gradually develop, which cannot be traced back to infancy, but will only appear clearly later in life. It will be a peculiarity of future evolution that there will be an increasing number of people regarding whom it will be asked, quote, "What can have happened to him in a certain year of his life? He is quite changed. He is like another being," close quote. This will become more and more frequent. Capacities will be manifested which previously were not there at all, which only appeared at a certain age. Those will be the souls which have developed furthest, and which manifest something like a certain break in their lives. For the fact that a person was a pupil of Buddha in the life between death and rebirth is not manifested at once, but only in later life. And this will be the case with those of whom we may say, We can trace their life up to a certain age when they manifested their individual qualities. Then an entirely different bent appeared. They came to understand things entirely differently from what they did before. These will be the people who in the future will also be the vehicles of true spiritual progress, who may perhaps be considered to be people who merely developed late, because it will be thought that previously they were undeveloped, and this was why these qualities only appeared late. The truth, however, is that these people only manifest in later life qualities which are their very own, because in former earthly incarnations they set up causes which enabled them to pass through the Mars culture in a particularly deep manner, and to acquire these powers through which they could act in an original manner in human evolution and bring a new impulse into it. For this reason, these human beings will contribute more and more to true spiritual development. I have already explained from a different point of view that these people, from their youth up, manifest but little tendency toward the spiritual standpoint they take up in later life. We now see that this is the reason why in the Rosicrucian movement one fact has always been brought into prominence, which we mentioned in the past, but the reason for which we could not give because we had not penetrated so far into its nature as we now have. Those who represented the principle of initiation in the West, in the Rosicrucian sense, have always stressed the fact that it is impossible in the case of true leading individualities to discover in their childhood that they are leaders, because they are people in whom a sort of break makes itself manifest in later life in the way we have described. When the seer now speaks of Buddha, he knows that Buddha has faithfully held to what his doctrine promised. He has continued to work for that in man which does not force its way directly to the physical body, and which therefore does not, from the beginning, appear incarnated in the physical body, but which only enters into man when the physical body has gone through a certain development, when it has, to a certain degree, arrived at the spirit. Then what Buddha gives to man appears, but only in later life. We must bear this in mind if we wish to understand the complete development of the human being. Later on in this course of lectures, we shall speak of what results from this for the individual human being, as regards his life between birth and death. The end of Lecture 7.